me fooled, spun me round, kept me down, and safely under you took all I had to give and more. You left me on the floor, couldn't find a way to crawl out of the days, turn into nights, darkness to light. Seasons keep changing. Time, time is my friend after all.
What a voice. That was Portland's own incredible Shoshana Bean. She'll be performing in Portland at Beaverton High School on March 21st. She's premiering her album, Spectrum. She's going to be accompanied by an 18-piece band. Her commitment to arts in schools is palpable. This is a fundraiser for the Beaverton High School Performing Arts Department and will be a once-in-a-lifetime event. When I saw Shoshana play Elphaba in the first national tour of Wicked, she blew the roof off. I'll play Remember the Day in its entirety at the end of this podcast, and we'll be speaking to Shoshana on the podcast broadcast on March 19th. Why do we sound so good? Because we're at Dead Aunt Thelma's studio, and Mike Moore is engineering for us. Thanks, Dead Aunt Thelma's. Thanks, Mike. Hey, everybody, I'm Susanna Mars, and welcome to Adventures in Artslandia. I'm sitting across from Sharon Knorr. She's an actor, producer, director, storyteller, singer, playwright, author, and collage artist, which I didn't know. She wrote a one-woman show, Why Can't I Marry the Cute Beetle? And after falling in love with storytelling, she created a story performance group called Solo Speak and is producing a series called Nevertheless, We Persist. Hey, Sharon.
Hi.
Thanks so much for coming today.
Thanks for asking me.
Yeah. As we were just talking about, as freelance artists, both of us are always happy to have something to actually put clothes on for.
Exactly. Yeah. To put makeup on. Yeah.
So you're doing this incredible series, Nevertheless, We Persist. Can you describe it to everybody?
Well, it's stories by women. I went to the Women's March here in Portland last year, a little over a year ago, and was so inspired by the solidarity of that day. Mm-hmm. My granddaughter went with me. One of my favorite things was the Portland police with their pink hats on, smiling at everybody. And because of the current political climate,
and the Me Too movement,
You know, as an artist, you think, what can I do? Mm-hmm. What can I do? And then I thought, well, we can tell our stories. The women can tell our stories. Because I think that, and it isn't a man bashing or a Trump bashing or anything political. Mm-hmm. It's just women standing on a stage telling their personal stories and how, with the stuff that women have gone through in their lives, they're still standing there. They're still persisting. And I think that that's a really strong political statement, just that. And I don't care if it's how to bake a good apple pie, or if you cured cancer, or if you survived cancer. All of it is a really good, interesting story. And it's been really successful. I was kind of surprised how quickly it started selling out. And I think women are hungry for that.
I agree. This morning I go on a run. I'm training for the Eugene Half Marathon.
Oh, good for you.
Both of my daughters are genius runners.
I know, I've seen them on Facebook.
I'm just trying to keep up with my kids. And I started thinking the term woke. You know, I heard the term woke first, really, I think right around the election time. And I thought, woke, what the heck does that mean? And I kept thinking of it as a term that was something that you were, right? But then as I did a little research, I found this great YouTube video of some women on, I think it's on Essence magazine, and they were talking about it being that you recognize that the world is not a simple place and that justice hasn't happened for everyone, that your eyes are wide open and you're paying attention. It's ongoing. And it's like part of what, it really reminded me of what you're doing.
Yes, yes. And that I as I coach these, we rehearse for 4 weeks, and as they create their own stories, and I help bring, I'm like a doula, I help bring out their feelings from inside. And sometimes they don't even know that that's how they felt. You know, I'm always saying, I know what you did. I want to know how you felt when you did it. And we've had some great stuff happen with people. Storytelling heals the teller, and it also can heal the audience, because there's everybody has their story, whatever it is. And usually there's one person in the audience, maybe more, that really needed to hear your story. Mm. I always say at my shows, I know a lot of you came to hear your friend tell a story, but it may not be the story you're here to hear. Mm. You know, there may be a story in the second half, so don't leave is my, you know, subtitle. There may be a story in the second half that you really came to hear, that you really need to hear. Mm. And it's just speaking truth.
Mm. It must be incredibly moving.
It is, and it is. And I love performing, but I also love coaching. Mm-hmm. I really love it, to see what happens to people.
So if someone wants to participate, what's the process and how long does it take?
To get started this year, I Facebook messaged and emailed people that either I knew or knew of, because I'm trying to make it not just actresses and other kinds of people that I thought would be good, and asked a variety of people, and some and said yes. And so I've pretty much filled up the whole season with people. It's usually 5 to 6 of us. And then we rehearse for 4 Mondays. You know, first we have ideas. Then they do their rough drafts and we go through it. And I coach, and it's opened up to the group. So we all get really close. Everybody gets so close. And each time there's a new group of women for the next show, I feel like I'm cheating on the last group, because we get so close. And now I'm hanging out with these women, you know.
What a great way to stay connected with women who are risk takers.
Yes. And meeting new people, because some of the people I've asked, I'm not their best friends, so it's been great to get to know people at a deeper level as well.
Yeah. That's incredible. So you have the events going all the way up until the summer.
Yes, until May. Yeah.
And where do they take place?
At the Sanctuary, which is where Triangle Production is. Mm-hmm. He has a little cabaret space. It only has 45 seats. Mm-hmm. So that's why
it's on Sandy and around 23rd.
17th and Northeast Sandy. Mm-hmm. And I think part of why this is working is because this space is small and it's very intimate. It's just like people sitting around talking. And that's why the tickets sell out. You know, it's one thing selling out a 200-seat theater, and this is a 45-seat theater, but that's all right. It still sells out.
Yeah, and it feels good to be.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
What are some of the more memorable stories that you've worked on?
Well, we did have a rape story last time, and she had happened 40 years ago, and she had really felt that she was okay. But I asked her some questions, and she realized that there was a lot of it she wasn't okay with. And it really caused her to go deeper in the process, and it was a really healing time for her. And then I want everybody to know that there's also funny stories. Mm-hmm. You know, my friend Judith Rizzio told a story. She's had so much death in her life, family members, a child, a brother, parents, and how she uses humor to be able to continue in her own life. Mm-hmm. And so that was a sad and funny story. Mm-hmm. And that's what most of them are. There's sad and funny, because that's what life is.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's woke.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's complicated.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's such a great area there, too. There are lots of places to eat, and it's a really up-and-coming, cool neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah. And Don has done such a nice job with the theater. Mm-hmm. And there's usually a show in the big stage, and then we're in the little stage. Mm-hmm. And I've also gotten potential ticket buyers, because they'll come over to me and go, well, what are you doing over here? You know, oh, that sounds good. I'll come next time, you know. So that's good. And I hope maybe they'll go to his shows, you know.
Right. I'm sure they see something cool's going on. They want to check it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what's your regular day like? I was talking earlier to you about being a freelancer, you're a producer, you're an artist. How do you plan your days out, your life out?
Well, it's surprising how much time putting on a little show is. You know, I spend a lot of time emailing and putting stuff on Facebook and emailing my email list and my storytellers.
Right.
I have a big dog that sits and looks at me all morning until I take him out.
That's your outdoor activity.
That's my outdoor activity.
For which you have to take off your pajamas.
Yeah. So, well, sometimes I just put on a big coat.
There you go. Oh, I forgot about that. That's the beauty of winter.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't know, by the time you take care of stuff in your house and fix food, and I've also been, since I moved back to Portland from Bend over a year ago, I buy tickets to everything. Mm. I go to all this theater, and sometimes I say to myself, I just want to stay home. So it seems like I'm out at night a lot.
What have you seen recently?
Oh, I just saw Penny Arcade.
Oh my gosh, I wanted to see that. I'm in rehearsal right now, and I was just heartbroken.
Oh, she was amazing. And
that's
then,
Boom Arts production. I can give Ruth a shout out because she is bringing great stuff to
she
Portland.
Is. Everything we've seen, we have loved.
Yeah, it's really
and
great.
Then I took a workshop last night from Penny.
You took that?
Yeah.
Okay, tell us about it.
Well, she was just, she's so inspiring.
She's all about authentic living and authentic storytelling.
Oh, yeah. And so there's about 25 people there, a lot of young people.
Great.
And as you know, you and I have been doing this for such a long time. Mm-hmm. And I hear these young, they weren't all actors, they were writers and so forth. And they're, you know, well, I just don't know how to get started. And I want to do this and I want to do that. And I'm thinking, oh, that sounds so familiar. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me, I'm sure you might feel this way sometimes too, it reminds me that I've worked really hard all these years and I'm actually doing what I love.
Yes.
And that's not an easy thing to do.
It isn't.
Yeah.
And I feel very much the same.
Yeah.
And it's a complicated life. It's when you wake up and you start, I really reach for feeling like I'm in the flow of where I'm supposed to be.
Yes.
It's kind of one foot in my calendar and another foot in a spiritual connection with what ideas. It's so exciting when you feel like you're in the flow creatively because a lot of things come up. And for any artists, young people, you know, it I would think it would be daunting. It's just, as we were talking about earlier, you don't have the alarm goes off and you get in your car and you go to the same place.
No. And Penny talked about the fact that to some of these people who were maybe 25, you know, that, well, yeah, you might not be doing it now, but if you keep going in 20 years, you'll be doing.
That's
and
right.
I'm sure to them, they're going, oh my God, 20 years. But when I look back, it's been a lot more than 20 years.
Right.
And she's right.
Yes.
You know, she's right. And what I admire about her is she's 68, I might have said, and she's still doing it.
Right.
And going all over the world, you know. She was really fun and
What did her piece focus on?
It's called Longing Lasts Longer.
Which I love that title.
And
Longing Lasts Longer. It's exactly what we were talking about.
Yeah, yeah. And what she says is, I'm not nostalgic for the past, but I'm longing for the past. And so she's talking about a lot of things that have changed and how it's all... So much stuff is bullshit now, and everybody wants to be an artist, and most of them aren't any good, and you know. And she was very funny, very funny, and not afraid to say what's what.
Right?
You know? Yeah.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
You wanted to be your girlfriend, you know. You wanted to hang out with her, and basically last night, that's kind of what we were doing. Mm. But she went around and talked to each one of us, and what is it that you want to do now? And I said, I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I want to do more,
right?
But I'm doing it.
Well, what did she say?
Great.
Go, girl.
Because another thing I do is I'm going to continue, is I'm doing storytelling with veterans.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's a mission of mine that I really want to get going. And I have a veteran who was in my first show, and he's really gung-ho about it. So together, we're going to do a Memorial Day show at ART.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, it was interesting. I've been writing something for a long time, and I started to think about what if stories were currency?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because I think listening to someone else's story and being really engaged mm-hmm. in a conversation mm-hmm. is life-giving.
And I always say that we all know that if you go to a corporate meeting or even if you go to church and you hear a sermon, mm-hmm. you don't remember the facts and the figures and the pie chart and the this and the dates or anything like that, but you remember how they made you feel. Mm-hmm. And you'll lose attention if things are being too factual. But the minute they say, well, when I was a little boy, my dad and I used to go fishing, mm-hmm. all of a sudden now you're interested in it. Yeah. And so I really encourage people to, if they're giving any kind of a presentation, to make it personal. Mm-hmm. Tell a story.
Yeah, it's interesting too. I have a friend, Jackie Maddox, who you may
yes.
know. She is writing a piece about time. And
I
often feel that when you're engaged in that way, that connected way, mm-hmm. time stretches in a weird way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's being in the zone.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's so exciting.
Yeah. Yeah.
It really shifts, you know, your experience of time and having more.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's really yeah. fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
So if you could choose something to wake up to in the morning, what would it be? What would you like to wake up to every morning? It's hard, right?
Yeah, it is.
I'm terrible at these kinds of questions because I always think, well, that. Oh, no, that would be better. It's like the question of if the genie came out of a bottle and I said you can have three wishes, what would you say? Like, well, I'd wish for more wishes.
That's a good one.
That's ridiculous.
The first thing that came to my mind was sunshine.
Mm.
That was one nice thing about Bend. It was always sunny, mm-hmm. even though I'm a true Portlander. Mm. I love the rain. I mean, if I wake up and it's raining, of course, I just want to stand under the covers and read or something. But the first thought that came to my mind was sunshine.
Oh, that's so interesting. I didn't even think about sunshine, and you're so right. Because there's something about that light coming in through the window.
Yeah,
it's really
yeah.
hopeful.
And blue sky. And
blue
you know.
Sky. Just listen to Mr. Blue Sky this morning. Love that song. I can run so much faster when I listen to it. So if you could pick any generation to grow up in, which would you choose?
I don't know.
That's hard, right?
It's really hard because I think of, it reminds me of Penny Arcade. You know, uh-huh. she says, not nostalgic for the 60s because it was this and this and this. And then there was the 70s and it was this and this and this. And that's kind of what I'm thinking. I mean, I think growing up I did grow up in the 60s. I think that was okay.
Mm-hmm. I know if you go too far back, life was really hard.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
for most people.
Yeah, yeah. I think I'm okay with what I did grow up in.
You're hip to the 60s.
I wouldn't have been, I mean, I think about the 1920s, but of course, when we think of that, we think of all the fun things we see in movies. Not,
right, not
how
real
difficult life would have been.
And mm-hmm, especially for women.
For women, yeah, yeah.
Be like wrapping your breasts so you could be flat-chested.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have to do that, but other people would.
I wouldn't want to be a young person now.
Yeah, it seems hard.
It's hard. It's very hard. You know, they just have a hard time getting a job. They have a hard time knowing what they want to do. How can they afford to even buy a house? You know, that kind
right.
of stuff. So
the things we're talking about in terms of connection mm-hmm. is where I also think they really have a hard time because our
yeah.
culture is pushing them farther and farther away from, A, having the time to make those types of connections, and mm-hmm. then the tools. You know, everything that's new in the world is about, you know, tell Alexa what you want.
Yes.
Get on your phone,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah. And Alexa and the phone don't fight back.
No.
You know?
Well, that's interesting. That's a really interesting way you put that.
Yeah.
They're easier
to get along with,
oh,
I think.
Because you just know. Tell them what to do.
Yeah. I know my grandson has a hard time with people, you know, because he's sensitive. I know that's a thing to think about, you know.
Yes. How often do you have younger women in the story event?
Well, I haven't had. Mm-hmm. And one of the women from last time, her niece came to see the show mm-hmm. and is really interested in telling a story. And I don't have an opening at this point, mm-hmm. but I said, well, that's great because I'd love younger people. Mm-hmm. And my granddaughter, who's 25, said, I want to learn how to tell a story. I went, great, would you be in the show? And she goes, oh, I don't know that I want to tell it in front of people. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, most of the people who come to this don't want to do it either. And mm-hmm. they're just terrified. Mm-hmm. I mean, as a performer, I don't get that. You can't get me off the stage. But they're just terrified. But storytelling, especially in a small little space, after about the third sentence, they realize that these people are just sending them love and they have smiles on their faces and that it becomes, I can just see them relax and mm-hmm. get into it. But we have crying and laughing and people are really affected. It's great. It's great.
That's interesting. I mean, it would be fun to see, you know, an evening of all one age group, you know?
Yes,
just
yes.
What they're thinking about.
I haven't worked in my career with young people very much, except mm-hmm. maybe to produce something with children in mm-hmm. it, dear God. And, so I haven't tried that, but mm-hmm. but I get asked, mm-hmm. do you work with teenagers? I mean, well, I haven't, but I think I'd be okay.
Oh, golly, that would be so, what a great thing to
do. And I think that they have a lot to say.
Oh,
that's
gosh,
for sure.
Yeah. And not a lot of place to say it.
No, no. And one woman in the last show said something very interesting. The one thing about storytelling is, you know, when you're talking about a problem with a friend, mm-hmm. they interrupt you. Mm. And they'll go, oh, well, I know, don't feel like that. Or, oh, you know, that happened to me 10 years ago. And then
or
they
the ever-famous, what you should do is.
Yes, what you should do is. And that you never get to finish your story. Mm. And that story, I never thought of this before. Mm. Storytelling, for 15 minutes, nobody's interrupting you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you can really get it out. And nobody's telling you, don't feel that way. You know, because mm-hmm. we get so much don't feel that way.
Yes.
And our feelings are valid no matter what they are.
Oh, they're such a beautiful, amazing part of being human.
Yeah, yeah.
That's so great. And when you give attention to another person, when I've listened to people do storytelling,
yeah,
it's very, very almost holy.
Oh, yeah.
Not even home, almost. to see someone take stage and be given time
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
to speak mm-hmm, their story. Mm-hmm, it's mm-hmm. really amazing.
Yeah, it is. It's like I've found my calling, everything mm-hmm. I've done. I don't really even have any desire to be in a play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to speak somebody else's words. I think you might agree with me that when we're acting, we're mm. always saying somebody else's words. And sometimes as the character, or sometimes things aren't written very well,
mm-hmm.
but as the character, you have this longing to say something to the other character, but the playwright didn't give you the words to say it.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about yourself, you're telling your own story, you really can go through whatever it is that you want to say until I edit it for you.
I'm always fascinated when I write a story down, and then I say it to myself, and often I record myself and I listen to it,
uh-huh.
that what I learn about the story and myself.
Oh, yeah.
I thought this was about that. Oh, my God. Wow, that's weird.
Yeah.
So fascinating.
I remind my people all the time, tell me again, what is your story about?
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think it's about that. I think it's about this.
Mm-hmm.
And Darcelle, I wrote one man show with Darcelle.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it. It wasn't done in drag. He did it as Walter.
Mm-hmm.
And he says everybody should write a one-person show, even if they never perform it, just because of what it does for you. And he was 80 years old when we did that. He's 87 now. And he had been abused as a child. And at one rehearsal, he said something that he'd never said before, and he just started sobbing, sobbing and sobbing and sobbing, and we had to quit rehearsal for that day. It was just he and I and Roxy, his partner, and he sat down, he goes, where did this come from? I'm 80 years old, you know. This happened when I was 14, you know. But I think that feelings, especially bad feelings, are like a cauldron of molasses or something that's boiling, and these bubbles slowly come up and they burst. And that's what happened to him. Something just came up, and it really cleansed him. I mean, you know, and he felt lighter after that, I guess. And that's what happens with this.
When you take the time to think and look at and share, I think part of that probably is that gift that you gave in working on the piece also, you know, in that partnership and listening and giving.
Yeah. Yeah, we met every Monday night for a year, drank a bottle of wine, and I taped his stories. He'd just tell me stories. And then I would take what I thought were the best, and then we made this show. It was really wonderful.
And it's also a book.
It's also a book, yeah. Yeah.
People
it's called
could...
Just Call Me Darcelle on Amazon.com.
So one more kind of fun question.
Yes.
I hope you think it's fun. If you knew it would be published, name someone alive or dead whose biography you would love to write. You would have full access to their life.
I know exactly who it is. My partner, Paul, worked for J. Edgar Hoover and has written a book about that. But J. Edgar Hoover's secretary was named Helen Gandy, and she worked for him for 52 years or something like that. And nobody knows really anything about her. Mm. And it would have to be a magical thing that we could find out about her life. But she basically ran the FBI because she ran his office. And I find her fascinating. And I keep saying to Paul, why is there no information about this woman? She just sounds amazing. She'd also make a great one-woman show.
Yes.
But there's nothing written about her. So, I, you know, there'd have to be some magic potion that would open up this information about her. But
right, you'd have to start really digging.
I know. I don't even know.
I wonder if there's anyone alive who would remember her.
Yeah, and Paul was good friends with her, but he knew very little about her personal life as well.
Oh.
So, interesting.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. So the thing that's really rocking your boat right now is the work you're doing.
Yes.
Is there anything else or anywhere you want to take it that you haven't yet that you're looking forward to?
I'd like to continue. I think it's the kind of thing, you know, when people have a restaurant that has like 10 tables and they're really, really busy with lines outside, and then they move it to a bigger space and it doesn't work because people liked the little space. I kind of think that's what the deal with these stories, this space I'm doing at Dawn's Theater, because it's a little space, you know. So I just think I'd like to continue doing it there for another year. I don't want the public to think that it's a Me Too thing, because we have Margie Boulay this month. Mm-hmm. She's telling a long story about her TV career and all the sexual harassment that she endured through all those years. Mm-hmm. And one of her girlfriends said, oh, I'm so tired of hearing all that. And I went, what's all that? This isn't a Me Too show. You know, we've had a rape story and Margie's going to do a sexual harassment story, but everybody else's stories is not about that. So I want to be sure that it stays to be just stories of women's lives, things that we've all gone through, children, death, alcoholism.
Harassment.
harassment, whatever it is, you know.
Who's the woman who said, I don't want to hear any more about that. That's what I wonder.
I know.
Who on this, what the devil?
That's what I wanted to say to her. What kind of friend do you have?
I go, what? I don't want to hear about that.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Don't come.
Go into your little hole and crawl into your hole.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's weird.
Yeah. I think also that the Me Too movement and now the Time Out thing is helping my shows because I think women are really telling their stories. And I have women who come every month.
That's great.
And Don tells me that when they leave the theater, because he's out there in the lobby, that everybody's going, oh my God, it was so fabulous. Are they going to do it next month? And oh, I'm so inspired. And I had one woman last time just come up and just hug me really hard. It felt like 10 minutes, didn't say anything to me, just hugged me and then looked me straight in the eye and walked away. And and that one was really moving, really moving.
It is.
Yeah.
And I do think that women telling the truth, and I believe anyone being authentic in their story, is uncomfortable. It's hard.
Yeah.
And it is funny. I mean, it's every emotion.
Yeah.
And it's getting woke. I'm getting that term is kind of insinuating its way into my understanding. And I think it's a beautiful thing. It's hard to imagine now coming into the belief system that uncomfortable is good.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it is.
And that it's a sign.
It is. Yeah.
Something's going on. And even the woman who said, oh, I don't want to hear any more about that, I would venture that she has some things beneath the surface that are troubling her.
That are being triggered by listening to the other stories. Yeah. Yeah. I say two things. First of all, I go, don't let the truth get in the way of a good story. And also, there's been a theme that's come out because I've done, let's see, this is my fourth show, I guess, so far. And there's a theme that's coming out, especially for those of us who are over 50, of really being a journey to be our true selves. Mm-hmm. How much we have to overcome, parents, school, husbands, the workplace, that we got punished for if we would be, you know, loud. I grew up in the theater, and I felt that my true self was when I was at the theater because I didn't, if I was loud or singing or did cartwheels down the hall, I wasn't a unladylike, noisy girl. Mm-hmm. I was talented. And that's, I think, what saved me was the theater and being at, I went to Portland Civic Theater School and being there two or three times a week. I felt I was at home. Mm. And that's a theme that we've been having. And a lot of stories have mothers that were, you know, difficult and jerky fathers and, you know, and terrible husbands.
Right. It runs the gamut.
Yes.
And it is perfect because the series is called Nevertheless, We Persist.
Right. Yeah.
And it's just you kind of, this is not a great analogy, but it reminds me of the Bozo the Clown, the punchy clown, you know, that anyone's punching you. No. I don't like, not the violent part.
Yeah.
But that you got to get pushed down and you get back up.
You bounce back up.
And you get back up.
Yeah.
And not to think of it. I don't like my analogy at all now that I'm saying it out loud, but, you know, just that things happen.
Oh, they do.
And then you have this opportunity to say, I don't want that to happen again, or I like that, maybe we'll try it like this, and that's the beauty of life.
Well, I always say to people, I'll say something about, you know, well, this too shall pass, it gets better, the tide comes back in, and sometimes we go, oh, that's that woo-woo stuff. And I go, well, it's kind of that woo-woo stuff, but it's really being so old that I know for a fact that the tide comes back in, and it'll go back out again.
It's so funny when someone says, oh, that's woo-woo stuff. No, actually, the tide really does go out and in. It's a fact.
Exactly.
And it's everything, it's the funny thing about nature, you know, people think it's woo-woo if you ever compare your life to nature.
Yeah.
Well, get on board, people. We're all a part of the nature.
Yes.
I mean, this is
the leaves
this
fall
is it.
Off, and then they come back.
Right?
You know?
And things are falling off.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for
talking
to me today.
Thank you.
And
always a pleasure.
Yeah, you can come go to the website solospeak.com and see when the next event will be, and go see Nevertheless, We Persist.
Yes.
Bye.
Next week, I'll be talking to the fantastic Shelley McClendon of Siren Theater. And don't forget that Rosie Rose Production is presenting The Three Sisters of Weehawken at Siren Theater March 16th through the 31st. The shows are at 8 p.m. Fridays and Saturdays and 2 p.m. on Sundays. That is sirentheater.org. And now, a chat with Gemma Whelan of Carib. Hi, everybody, and welcome to Adventures in Artslandia. We have a little extra this week, and I am sitting with Gemma Whelan, who is the artistic director and founder of Carib Theater, which we were just talking about how to pronounce that. And Gemma, be so kind to say it.
Yeah, it was perfect this time. Carib, and Carib is a river and a lake in the west of Ireland. The city of Galway is on the River Carib. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons I picked the name, because Galway is such an arts city. It's filled with arts. It's famous these days for the International Arts Festival, which takes place in Galway every July. Mm-hmm. Carib actually leads a theatre tour there every July, brings over people. But it was really the Druid Theatre. People may know the Druid, which is, you know, a lot of theatre in Ireland takes place in Dublin, and it's famous for the Abbey and the Gate. But Galway was more experimental in some ways, mm-hmm. and is also, it's a smaller city, and it also is in the traditional part of Ireland. So it's a mixture of both the modern and the traditional.
How long have you been here in Portland?
I've been in Portland almost 10 years.
Mm-hmm. And how long has Carib been a part of Portland?
Going on its sixth year now.
And
so,
what drew you to begin a theater company?
It was actually Wynne Goodbody, who was interested in Irish theater, asked me if I'd be interested in doing some readings. And I wasn't at all sure that I wanted anything to do with an Irish theatre company, because I had one in the Bay Area for several years. And it actually took me many, many years of directing before I even wanted to direct Irish plays, because I didn't want to be labeled as just an Irish director. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we started with a reading in a studio and wondering, does anybody care? Is there an interest in Irish theatre in Portland? It's not known for its Irish population. Mm-hmm. You know, it does have quite a few, but nothing like the Bay Area, for example, mm-hmm. or obviously Boston or New York. So we did a reading of A Night in November, which is a rather intricate and difficult one-man show, also very funny. Damon Cupper read the part.
Who is brilliant.
He is brilliant and was amazing. And we filled the space two weekends, so for two nights. And we thought, and then talked to people afterwards, and people were really intrigued by the situation, by Ireland, by the politics, and of course loved the humor. And that was it. We didn't really know that a company was being launched, mm-hmm. but that actually was the launch of the company. And we just continued from there and did shows at Kell's upstairs in the banquet hall, mm-hmm. and did a one-man show with Ted Roizam. Mm. Which was an amazing experience, and ended up doing a full production of A Night in November with Damon, which then moved to Coho. So we've sort of, you know, we've moved around. We've been nomadic. That's the way we've been, at least for the last 5 years or mm-hmm. so.
So the political intricacies of Ireland mm-hmm. compared with the political intricacies of what we're experiencing here mm-hmm. now in the United States, and then how you are using, you know, that what's happening in both places to highlight these conversations through theater.
Yes.
How are you doing that?
Well, I think, you know, Ireland is a very small country, as you know. It has about 4 million people. So, but in some ways, what's happened recently with Ireland is a microcosm of what has happened in the United States. Mm-hmm. So Ireland, people may know its history. It has a very troubled history. People have traditionally been very poor. Of course, the British came and took over and for hundreds of years ran the country. I only found out recently that there were actually Irish slaves, that the British rounded up people, sold them on the block, naked, in London, and sent them to Barbados.
Irish white?
Yes, were slaves.
Right.
Not indentured servants. There uh-huh. were. There was also, prior to that, this was in the 1600s.
Mm-hmm. And sent to Barbados.
Sent to Barbados to work side by side with the African slaves on the sugar plantations.
Oh, my.
Yes.
In the 1600s?
Yes. Yes.
That's
and the women were sent
know.
Really mostly as sex slaves mm-hmm. And children, a lot of children, because they were considered strong and they would continue to grow. Mm. So, so Ireland's had a very troubled history and then was very poor. And people may know about the Great Hunger, sometimes called the famine, but more recently the Great Hunger that happened in the 1840s, 50s, when there was the potato crop failed. So we grew up calling it the famine. Mm-hmm. But there was loads of food in the country, but the powers that be exported the food and sometimes under armed guard out of the country. So the first play we did this season, called Belfast Girls, was actually set during that time. Mm. It was five women who were actually, that was a bit of ethnic cleansing also. They were getting rid of undesirables, so-called undesirables. Many of the women were prostitutes. There was actually a huge rise in prostitution during the Irish famine because society fell apart. Mm. You know, a lot of women were abandoned, married women. Sometimes, you know, the men drifted away. So somebody, Earl Grey, not the actual Earl Grey of the tea, but a relation, came up with the idea that we should send some of these young Irish orphans who had lost their parents to the colonies in Australia. Mm. So there was, for several years, they transported young women to Australia, promising them a better life. But actually, most of them were not orphans, and most of them were not, they were supposed to be 19, were not 19 either. And but it was a way of getting rid of the people they didn't want.
So who were the people they did want? I mean, aristocrats, wealth, people of wealth.
Yes, and also people who wouldn't cause trouble and people who would ideally, there was a huge suspicion against Catholics and the Catholic faith. It still exists to some extent, associating the Catholic faith with, you know, magic.
Idolatry.
Exactly. And of course, the fact that the families were so large, they hated that idea that there was no birth control and they just kept having babies. And the idea, there was a fear of the Pope and Rome, and, you know, it was called popery, that they were under the spell of the Pope and would do everything the Pope said. So therefore, they couldn't really be ruled properly by the King of England. Mm. There was a huge, in my recent research for the play, especially for Belfast Girls, and just reading I've been doing recently, I've been coming up even more than what I was taught in school growing up.
Well, that's the way it is with so much now. You know, you have to when you start digging, all these stories that we've come to know as fact are being questioned.
Exactly.
Which is fantastic.
It is great.
But it really shakes you up.
Yes, it does.
Think, well, what?
I know. And you think you know your own history. And of course, I was taught history in a very pro-Irish way, you know, but still, when I think back on it now with what I know, it's like, it could have been even more. I mean, I don't think people knew. Some of this research is new, by the way. Mm-hmm. So the research on the slaves in Barbados, a lot of papers got lost and destroyed, which is why people didn't know about it.
Right.
This was my, you know, my preamble was talking about the tough history of Ireland, and that changed for the first time in the late 1990s, 1999, it was the first time there were associations with Europe, the European Union, and Ireland started to become prosperous, and there was a boom.
And as a result of what industry?
It was really trade with Europe, the tech, the high tech industry.
Really? Actually, that's interesting, isn't it?
Ireland has always been a leader in the high tech. It was also an early manufacturer of computer chips. And
Didn't know that.
Yeah. So in the early teens, so 1999 and then the early teens.
So recent.
It's called the Celtic Tiger.
It's so interesting because I saw that on your website and I thought, I need to ask, what's the Celtic Tiger?
Yeah, it was this unprecedented period of prosperity and people were able to buy things for the first time. And what happened, for the very, very, very first time in Irish history, the population started to grow. Hmm. You know, the population was decimated during the famine from deaths, from, people... I could go on about the famine forever, so I won't.
Right.
Death and immigration. And a lot of people came to this country. A lot of Irish who are here now, Irish Americans, their descendants came over. Their ancestors, their descendants of the people who came during the famine. So because of that, there was an influx of immigrants to Ireland. So from African countries, Sierra Leone, Nigeria, Eastern European, Bosnia, huge numbers from Poland.
Just a wheel.
Yes.
Just a wheel of everyone moving.
So Ireland started to change.
Wow.
And if you had gone to Ireland, or even today, because some of the people are still there, there was a crash, as there was here in 2007, 2008. So some people left during that time. There was also reverse immigration. young people who were still in their 20s, let's say, who had come here because there was no work in Ireland, they were educated, they often went back home because there were jobs. They were offered jobs, very good jobs. Mm-hmm. So there was this, it was really fairly brief. I mean, 2007, 2008 was the crash. Ireland is just about starting to recover. Mm. So, you know, Ireland then had to deal with immigrants. It had to deal with people of color, which they didn't have had to deal with before. And Ireland, Irish people who had been used to going to other countries and, as in this country, often discriminated against initially, as were many, you know, immigrant groups. But eventually, I mean, today, I would say the Irish are pretty much integrated here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've had it with John F. Kennedy, there was an Irish-American president for the first time, a Catholic president. That was a big deal for this country.
Yes.
So, I remember on my visits home to Ireland seeing notices, that meetings in libraries about how to deal with discrimination, how to get over this, what should our attitude be towards people who are coming in? Because there was discrimination,
of course.
You know, and pointing out that we have been welcomed in countries around the world for hundreds of years. So guess what? You know, and Ireland is famous for charitable donations, for being very open-hearted. It's famous for being welcome.
Generous.
But, you know, it's another thing if you think somebody is taking their job. Your job. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah. Worldwide.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So how then your work in theater, I would sense, is motivated by a desire to help people see new ideas.
Yes. Part of what I really want to do with Carib is let people know that our Carib Theatre and Irish theatre today is not the theatre of your grandmother, so to speak, you know, or of my grandmother, I could say. And that is not to, I love the traditional Irish playwrights, Sean O'Casey.
Of course.
I mean, they're amazing. John Millington Synge. They're brilliant. Even, you know, Brian Friel, who of course, you know, he's dead now, but he's a recent playwright.
He feels contemporary.
He feels very contemporary.
Made films,
and I love
of his plays.
Work. But part of our mission was to put on plays that people wouldn't normally see that the bigger theaters are not doing. So the bigger theaters, obviously, you know, the Conor McPherson's, the Martin McDonagh's, they're performed in New York. You know, they make movies.
They make movies out of Martin McDonagh's work.
Exactly, exactly. And then by some of the bigger theaters here in Portland, like Artist Rep does a good bit of Irish theater and has in the past also. And Third Rail loves Irish theater. So the plays that I'm doing are probably by playwrights that nobody has heard of. And I try and also look out especially for women playwrights because they have traditionally been underrepresented. Surprise. and so, you know, the a friend, two colleagues of mine wrote a book a few years ago called Staging Intercultural Ireland.
I'm so glad you brought this up because I think this is fascinating. And you can take a look at the website also to see what Carib is doing in regard to this. But I'll leave it to you to explain.
Yeah. So we did some readings a couple of years ago. One was a one-woman show. It was a young Bosnian immigrant to Ireland who had found her way to Ireland via the exotic dancing industry, which is a euphemism for whatever you may decide.
I guess it's whatever the woman decides it is.
Exactly. Okay. It's the way that she found her way to Ireland, and that's how she got into Ireland too. And then she ended up she's a playwright. And she started doing theater and so on. And the other one was Orpheus Road, which was actually set in Northern Ireland, but it was a twist on the normal Protestant Catholic divide, because the girl in the relationship she was white South African and of no religion, actually. So, and the young man who fell in love with her, it traces their relationship from about the age of 16. It's very sad, as many Irish plays are. It's not a happy ending. But so that was sort of our launch. And I mean, well, I'll talk about Quietly because there is an immigrant connection.
Great, that's the upcoming play.
Yeah. But just to say that the play that we're doing, my first play of next year's season, is called Hurl. Mm-hmm. And in that play, a group of recent immigrants and asylum seekers in Ireland, and actually not necessarily recent, some of them might have been living there for years. Some of them because they either can't find work or are not allowed to work under the terms of their entry into Ireland, they form a hurling team. And I'm not sure if people know what hurling is. Mm-hmm. It's a, yeah, so you do know, mm-hmm. Susanna. It's not curling.
And it's not throwing up.
No, it's not, exactly. It's played with a stick, like a hockey stick. Mm-hmm. It's actually, the stick is made of ash. And it's a very old sport in Ireland. That and Gaelic football are they're two of the traditional Irish sports. They're mm-hmm. very, very tied up with the rise of Irish nationalism, mm. which happened at the turn of the 20th century. When the Irish, we eventually got independence in Ireland in the 1920s, and it was sort of an indirect result of a final uprising in 1916. Mm. There had been uprisings all the hundreds of years going back. There was a lot of uprisings. 1916 was also a failure in terms of military because Ireland, they could never meet the might of the British Army. They could never, never win, mm-hmm. but they kept trying. In 2016, in 1916, mm-hmm. Because the leaders of the rising were just lined up and executed within days, it caused a huge, huge furor. Mm. And eventually, I mean, it's a complicated history I won't go into. There was a civil war in mm-hmm, Ireland. Mm-hmm. And that's actually what led to the partition in the north of Ireland. Why Ulster, which, you know, sets itself for Quietly, why Ulster became a separate province called Northern Ireland, ruled by England. Mm. And the other 26 counties in Ireland stayed. They became an independent state. Mm-hmm. It's called ERA, or the Republic of Ireland. But anyway, Hurl, this group of people in the west of Ireland form a hurling team. So you had to know that bit of history. Because of the rise of nationalism, it was associated with a pride in our own culture, in our own sports. Theater was a huge part of this rising nationalism, which eventually led to a push towards seeking independence, actually. Mm. The founding of the Abbey Theater, focus on Irish playwrights, because prior to that, a lot of the theater was English, was brought over from England. Or many of our most famous, very famous Irish playwrights like Shaw and Sheridan and Wilde went to London. They left, but they're actually Irish, but they're better known as people think of them as British.
Right.
So this group of people, they are from Bosnia, Sierra Leone, Nigeria, Argentina, Vietnam. You get the picture, yeah. And a few from the west of Ireland. They form a hurling team, and that it's fictional, but they take it to the All Ireland finals. So, by representing those people on stage, by representing the new Irish, if you like, it's like the new face of Ireland, and putting it on the stage in theater with hurling sticks that are this symbol of, you know, one could say a narrow definition of Irish or of nationalism.
A unique piece of the culture.
Exactly, exactly. So it already expands the idea of what it means to be Irish. Mm. And of course, within the play itself, there is racism by this other team who doesn't like it. Like, who are these people taking over our sport?
Right.
So it's represented on stage. So I think it's actually a really good example of the intercultural Irish initiative.
And that's something that's really a big part of Carib.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And that's really exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. I'm looking forward to it. It's a big play. It requires a lot of choreography. Mm. It's going to be a big leap for us in the sense of scale.
No pun intended.
Exactly. There's a lot of leaping.
A little bit about Quietly before we have to stop.
So Quietly is a contemporary play. It's set in 2008 in a bar in Belfast. And it sounds a little bit like a setup for an Irish joke. A Protestant and a Catholic walk into a pub and the bartender is Polish. So what the situation is, the two men are middle-aged. They're both 52. And we find out very soon, so it's not a spoiler, that the Protestant man has approached the Catholic and asked him to meet. They've never met before, so they're meeting in this pub. And we find out also fairly quickly that when they were both 16, so in the 1970s, the Protestant man, he was a boy, obviously, threw a bomb into that pub. This is at the height of the Troubles. Mm. And blew up the five men in the pub, including the father of Jimmy, of the Catholic, who was not involved in any paramilitary activity at all. Mm-hmm. So, and the bartender doesn't know. He's learning about this for the first time. He's from Poland. You know, he's an immigrant. He's been there for several years. He's trying to make his way in Ireland. And so it's really a truth and reconciliation play. In Northern Ireland, after 30 years of the so-called Troubles, which was basically, it was like guerrilla warfare that went on for 30 years and killed thousands of people. And it's a very complicated situation. It's not about religion. I mean, it's about power. Things tend to be about power and status, and you're having a place in society. And of course, it's connected to England and Ireland and identity. But there was a truce, a peace treaty called the Good Friday Agreement, which was signed in 1998. So this is actually the 20th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. Mm. A commission was set up in Northern Ireland to try and deal with the aftermath of the atrocities, but they didn't get very far because people didn't want to talk.
Right.
So in Owen McCafferty, who's a brilliant playwright, has written this play, which is really his response to the fact that that the powers that be they're not providing a structure
for moving through for civil moving war.
Exactly.
And that's an issue that is every country is facing.
Yes.
Reparations.
Yes, exactly.
And how to be able to live together among such pain and suffering.
Exactly, exactly. And of course, South Africa is an amazing example of this.
Palestine and Israel.
Yeah.
The United States.
Yeah.
I mean,
when the peace treaty was signed, I have always thought of the situation in Northern Ireland as equivalent to the Palestinians and the Israelis. Mm-hmm. And I really thought, because it would have been impossible for me growing up in Ireland to imagine there could be a treaty between these sides. They were so far apart and there was so much hatred. And I thought, well, if they can do it, and they did, and it was, it's a slow process and it's not perfect, but it happened. But in this play, this is sort of it's a personal truth and reconciliation with the Polish bartender as the witness.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
I
wish we could talk longer. It's impossible not to talk longer about these wonderful topics. And refresh everyone's mind about the website so that they can go on and see what else Carib is offering.
Yes. So it's caribtheatre.org, C-O-R-R-I-B, and theatre with an R-E. And quietly opens at New Expressive Works, which is 810 Southeast Belmont on Friday, April 13th, and the Irish Consul General in San Francisco, because it's the 20th anniversary, is coming up for our opening.
How exciting.
So that's quite an honor.
And is there an organization of Irish immigrants or citizens in the Portland area that people can connect with?
There are a few.
Mm-hmm. So people can look online and see what they can find.
They can.
But they can come to you, too.
They can also come to me. They
right.
can also come to me.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so lovely. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Just a delight and so exciting the work you're doing.
Thanks, Susanna. Mm-hmm.
And now, Remember the Day, Shoshana Bean.
Spun me round, kept me down, and safely under you took all I had to give and more. You left me on the floor, couldn't find a way to crawl out of the days, turn into nights, darkness to light. not the same when I look at